Gracious and loving God, open our hearts and our ears. May these words that I speak not be of mine, but of your Spirit. And may this hearing and speaking go beyond just standing at a pulpit and sitting at a pew. May they move us to action. Amen. So last Wednesday, Joshua Johnson, the host of 1A, an NPR show in town, interviewed a high school student from Charleston, West Virginia. And in the interview, he asked her what she thought about the teachers on strike. By Wednesday, this past Wednesday, they were in 10 days of this strike, mind you, and the kids had missed almost 2 weeks of school. This young woman was part of a coalition of students who had stood in solidarity with the teachers. This young woman of 17 years old spoke eloquently about why a fair wage was important to the teachers and why their example mattered to the students. Johnson then asked her how students on free lunch, free or reduced lunch, were getting along during the strike, because as breakfast and lunch at school were the only meals they were able to eat during the week. This young woman's response was that the groups of students and teachers had been stocking up on money and food in order to feed the students during this strike. Young people, children, were just as important to this movement in West Virginia, and as most of you have seen on the news, students and youth have been on the front lines demanding change as the victims of systems that have failed them. Young people have had to grow up so fast. Young people like Emma Gonzalez, who at the age of 18 speaks out as a survivor of gun violence. And every time we learn of a young black boy shot and killed by police, who is it we see marching and holding anxiety and grief of another friend lost? Too many faces of young people. Young people like Nayeli and David, Alejandra, Josue, Jamie, and Jimena, who risk their lives daily when they leave their homes to go to school, to work, to church, or when they protest because as young children, they were brought to the U.S. and now the promise they once had held as a way to thrive was taken away. So now, yet again, they have no choice but to fight. Fight for their legal right to exist, to thrive, to be recognized as a person of value. Because the systems that were put in place meant to be protections for the vulnerable have now become methods of harm. Young people indeed have been the veterans of creative suffering. In the context of King's speech, creative suffering looked like hot coffee burns and dog bites and water hose bruises. The creative and unearned suffering still exists today, and physical harm is still very much a reality for people. But I would add that the creative suffering today comes in a systemic form so ingrained in policy and in culture that if we are not willing to notice it, we miss it. Racist immigration policies, tax laws that benefit the rich and the powerful, certain lobbies that would have us believe that the money donated to politicians is a work of keeping Americans safe, victim blaming and shaming, and when we overlook the realities of suffering brought on by systems that have been the norm for so long, we have denied both the humanity in those who suffer and the divine found within them. In the gospel passage that Jeremy read earlier, we find Jesus and his disciples in the throes of ministry. At this point in their time with Jesus, they have seen a few things that one can only imagine they did not expect to witness. I mean, when they said yes to him on the seashore, did they expect to hear their beloved Torah reinterpreted? Did they expect to work the crowd control for this odd man who healed the blind with mud? Did they expect to be mocked and laughed at by locals thinking they had lost their damn minds? They have witnessed Jesus heal the sick, feed people who hungered for his teachings. And just before this particular passage, Jesus has named Peter the rock of the church. One of them, the rock of the church. They're finally getting the hang of this ministry thing with Jesus. And just when everyone is getting comfortable with each other, just as they have learned each other's Myers-Briggs and Enneagrams, just when they've got this good thing going with this odd and great teacher, he gives them a bit of uncomfortable news. The passage says, from that time on, Jesus began to show his disciples that he must go to Jerusalem and undergo great suffering at the hands of the elders, the chief priests, the scribes, you know, the institution, and be killed, and on the third day be raised. And just as quickly as Peter became the rock of the church, too big for his britches, Peter takes Jesus aside, and the passage says Peter rebukes him. He says, God forbid it, Lord. This must never happen to you. Surprised and frustrated, and I imagine maybe face-palming. That's what I imagine, Jeremiah. Jesus looks Peter, the rock of the church, square in the eye and says, get behind me, Satan. Now, I don't know about you, but 2,000 years later, and I find myself retroactively cringing for Peter. Like, have you ever thought of something you've done that was embarrassing 5 or 10 years ago and still kind of blush about it? I know we've all done that. Don't lie. Like, you have to wonder if his reaction was a gut reaction to Jesus' words, or if he even heard the third day, I will rise again bit. But I guess either way, if you've seen Jesus perform miracles for the last few months, you have to at least suspect that what he is saying is true, right? The trouble in this story is twofold, in that Jesus and Peter are both the victims of a dysfunctional system. You see, Jesus is aware that what he has been teaching, what he has been proclaiming, a law founded on love, a call to be inclusive of women and of foreigners, of the poor, of the sick, a liberator of the imprisoned, of the enslaved, Jesus has gotten in the way of the institutionalized faith. Jesus has seen that the chief priests and scribes and rabbis have gotten too comfortable in their power, in their place of privilege among the empire. So those in power begin to plot. And Jesus, being fully divine and fully human, knows fully well what is coming. And Peter, bless his heart, Peter too has been failed by the system. Failed because Peter cannot see beyond the human capacity of what justice work ought to be. Peter for so long has seen the leaders of his faith sit comfortable in the synagogues. Peter cannot comprehend that a true liberator will cause some trouble. Peter cannot understand that the work of redemption and reconciliation can get you killed. Peter cannot understand that the Messiah, Jesus, can defeat death. Peter, yet again, has his mind set on human limits, thus denying the divine power of Jesus to defeat worldly things like death. And this is dangerous because when Peter denies the very real suffering that Jesus would endure, Peter also denied the suffering people of faith would and will experience for the sake of love and justice. It's easy to think about faith and church abstractly, to dwell on the knowledge and academic notion of faith, because the alternative, or rather the partner of a visible church, is to endure and dive into the mess of the human condition, of racism, of sexism, of ageism, and any ism that denies the divine found within the children of God. So, back to the scene with Peter. Jesus, the main 12 disciples, and all of the other folks who have been hanging out with Jesus. Jesus has just let Peter have it, and I am sure everyone else around him is red in the face, embarrassed for Peter. Maybe even a little relieved that it was him that got it yelled at by Jesus. Because, let's be real, had we been disciples, one of us, maybe even some of the more extroverted people in the room, we might have been the one to tell Jesus. Heaven forbid it. I will confess that I too retroactively breathe a sigh of relief, knowing that Peter took that hit for me. Jesus looks at his followers and tells them that the work of God was not meant to be easy. And like the nets they dropped when he called them, they have to be willing to cast aside their lives for the sake of God's work. And here's the redemption for Peter and for us. Jesus still uses Peter for the mission of God. Just like Jesus will overcome death, Jesus still finds value in Peter. And Peter can and will see the cracks in the system he has grown accustomed to. And so the good news of the gospel is this: we are liberated from the perfect work of the invisible purity of God that praises doctrine over doing, and we are then free to follow Jesus into the imperfect mess of justice work, from imperfect prophetic action all the way to the cross. And what is so liberating is that we are not held back by the notions of what will people think, what will people do, because to suffer with those on the margins, to see and recognize that there is real suffering in justice work, is to be liberated from any structure that has told us perfection and established oppression is good and right. Jesus invites his followers to take up their cross, and sometimes that walk is with a heavy cross and not a quick walk. Are we willing to surrender our pride, our ego, our status, our comfort, and even our lives for God's sake? In this last part of Jesus' teaching to his disciples in verse 27, Jesus says, "For the Son of Man is to come with his angels in the glory of his Father, and he will repay everyone for what has been done." It is written to assume that the return of God was coming soon. And early Christians were pretty serious about this. Jesus' contemporaries believed that they would see Jesus within their lifetime. So even interpreters can get confused with how to interpret this part of the story, because we've not seen that grandiose return of the Messiah we've been hearing about for the last 2,000 years. But two things come to mind about this particular way Jesus ends his lecture to the disciples. This part of the text reminds us that we may not live to see the fulfillment of the gospel work. Jesus did not live to see the disciples carry on the work. Peter did not live to see the early church thrive. Dr. King did not live to see his legacy live on, continually working for beloved community. And even we might not see the fulfillment of God's return for the world, but Jesus tells us again and again that the resurrection will come. Love will be fulfilled. And the second thing is this: I will confess that I am not a Greek or Hebrew scholar. In fact, by the grace of God, I barely passed Greek and Hebrew. But what if this particular part of Jesus' return that Matthew is talking about happens when we answer that invitation to lose our lives? When we value the peace and the love of God over the institutions and the systems and the denominations that have caused harm? What if we usher in the coming of Jesus when we deny our ego and our pride? Father Gustavo Gutierrez, one of the fathers of Latinx liberation theology, emphasized the practice over doctrine. He believed that since Jesus was born of flesh, grew up poor, mocked, ridiculed, sentenced for crimes he did not commit, then that God has a special connection with the poor, the marginalized, the imprisoned, those demanding justice from below. And again, this reminds us that we too are liberated when we relinquish that grip of power when we dive into that messy imperfection work of reconciliation, we're reminded that only then will our gospel work change the situation, as Dr. King says. This is the mystery of the gospel. It is both blessing and sacrifice, both thesis and antithesis. But let us not confuse suffering for what is right and good with abuse and harassment. Because for too long, suffering for God's will has been used to justify the abuse of men and women, and we must always, always ask ourselves, does this work point to the inclusive, gracious love of Christ? Does this work redistribute power? Am I getting in the way of oppression, or am I getting in the way of some good trouble? Dr. King tells the crowd to go back to Mississippi, to Alabama, to South Carolina, to Georgia, to the ghettos and slums of the North, and keep the faith, knowing that the suffering work of justice was not in vain. That is a hard ask for the people of God, for people who have suffered and have endured those hot coffee pots and the hoses and the dogs and the bomb threats. And I remember back to the story of Joseph and Mary bringing their newborn to the temple. Remember when the old prophet Simeon takes Jesus from Mary's hands, an ancient promise held in the arms of an ancient hope. And Simeon tells Mary he will be the cause of the falling and rising of many in Israel and will generate opposition. As a result, he will show the true colors of many. What catches me and gives me hope is that Simeon's words, he says the fall and the rise, not the rise and fall that is the normal narrative that we hear. And what I love about this is that it is a prophetic reminder that the work of God is not yet done, and we are to keep the faith that reconciliation will come. On this fourth Sunday in Lent, we are almost there, almost at the greatest defeat of evil. Dr. King tells us not to wallow in the valley, not to stay down, but to rise up and keep going. I'm reminded of these words from Dr. Howard Thurman, those two questions that you always have to ask yourself in this work of justice and peace. The first is, where am I going? And the second, who will go with me? If we ever get these questions in the wrong order, we are in trouble. Friends, God has called us, God has invited us to the good and reconciliatory work of justice. So where are you going? Who is going with you? Is this journey taking you to the work of justice and peace? Does it point to the inclusive and liberating love of Jesus? Only then do we know that this work that we are doing, that we are enduring, is good. Amen.